Welcome to Legend Lore with Luis and Lorne, where we talk about Pathfinder 2nd Edition.
I'm Luis, and I'm a developer at Paizo working on the Pathfinder Lost Omens line. I've been playing tabletop RPGs for over 15 years, and I've written for dozens of Pathfinder products. I'm also the GM for Valiant, and I write the Monsters Physique blog here on the No Direction Network.
And I'm Lauren. I've been playing in RPGs for almost 20 years. You can watch me play in the Adventurous and Three Ring Adventure podcasts. And this week, we're talking more about the Mwanga Expanse, because we just couldn't cover it all last episode.
And before we get into it, we want to mention that although we know a lot about what we're talking about when it comes to Pathfinder, we want to remind you that we're not providing any kind of official answers. We're here to offer advice, and you can use that however you like. Remember that the official word from Paizo is the only official ruling out there. But don't forget, it's your game. Do what works best for your table.
All right, Luis. So now that we're getting into the people of the Mwanga Expanse, I'm going to be honest. I opened up this book, and I've been trying to get through this part of the book, and I'm riding the struggle bus. We've got three different kinds of elves here. We have the Alugi, the Akuje, and the Kaliji. But, like, how do you tell them apart? Like, aren't elves elves?
Oh, boy. I mean, you could ask that of any ancestry, right? I mean, how do you tell all those humans apart? Aren't they all just humans? No, there's a lot of differences going on with these elves of the Mwanga Expanse. Before I get into that, though, let me tell you about a different group of elves, which it isn't actually so different. It's a group called the Mwalije Elves. Way long ago, way before Earthfall, all these elves that you mentioned, they were all part of the same group. They were known as the Mwalije Elves. And then a prophecy happened. And this prophecy said, hey, there's going to be some great darkness. There's going to be some evil you have to fight. So get ready for that. And not all of these Mwalije Elves agreed on what that prophecy was referring to. And that caused a splintering among these elves. And that's how we developed the three different large groups of elves in the Mwanga Expanse, the Alije, the Akuje, and the Kaliije. So I think this kind of important event in Mwalije elf, in Mwangi elf history, is kind of the thing to really focus on each of these first, to determine who these different elves really are.
Are there any of the original Mwalije left? Or is, like, one of these faction kind of like, this is what they became? These are the ones that didn't splinter away.
I would say all three of these groups are still considered Mwalije. They just don't hang out together anymore.
Yeah, but, like, okay. All right, Luis. I get you. But Catholicism spawned all of these different branches, you know, of Christianity. But you can still be a Catholic, right? Yeah. Where did these guys go?
No, I mean, I think in this analogy, Mwalije is Christianity, which is this blanket term for the elves.
Oh, okay.
And then your Akuje and your Alije and Kaliije, those are your Lutherans and your Catholics and your Unitarians, sure.
Unitarians.
those don't actually map to any of those three, but, you know, three different sects, three different groups, right, okay, are all under the umbrella. They're all elves living in the Mwanga Expanse. They're all kind of intent on doing good and preventing evil from rising up. They just had different approaches, and they kind of went their own way. I'm sure a lot of them still end up working together, still end up being friends, but they are also their own distinct cultures, because this is an event that happened 10,000 years ago, if not longer. So it did lead to distinct differences between these groups. So let's take a look at what these groups are.
Oh, you don't want to talk more about non-denominational elves?
Maybe that's a different episode entirely. We can talk about all the different flavors of elves and how they map to... No, that's not fraught at all. We don't have to worry about that. Anyway, the first of these is the Alije elves. When the prophecy came about, it was the elves that would become known as the Alije elves that kind of first spoke of this prophecy. They were, a lot of elves back in the day had oral traditions, oral histories, and they're like, hey, we have this prophecy, there's an ancient evil coming, we got to do something about it. Let's write down the prophecy, because that's important. We haven't really written stuff down for a long time. We've just been speaking it, but this is so important. We don't want people to like lose track of this prophecy. All right, let's write it down. That's important. And we'll write it down among the walls of our city of Nagisa, which is a ruined city. I think, from what I can tell in the history, it was already ruins even when this happened. But we'll write it on the walls here so anyone can come find it whenever.
Well, I mean, technically, you're kind of like the Lost Omens guy, right?
Yeah.
If you declare here and now that it's ruins, that's canon. That's sure. How that works.
I guess so. Canonizing things. Another great aspect of... Anyway, the elves get to work on this, and they believe this ancient evil is demonic. It's demons, and they believe it to be, you know, all these wicked creatures from out and beyond Galarian. We got to fight this ancient evil. Let's go take care of them. And they have a feeling that this city, Nagisa, is kind of the hub of where this evil is set to be coming from. And they start exploring the city, and they find that, you know, the pyramids and buildings within the city, some of them have deep in the heart of the buildings, they have totems that are abyssal rifts or are connected to demons. There are symbols and runes for demons and stuff around. They're like, aha, we found the evil. This is the evil that they were talking about. This is what we're going to take care of. We're going to do our best to get as much information about these demons as we can and try to destroy them. We have gone from being oral traditionalists to being the archivists. We want to keep track of every single detail ever possible. We're creating writing. We're going to just remember as much as we can. And then we're going to do everything possible to stop this evil, even if it means dabbling a little bit into the demon stuff, both so we can understand it and maybe wield it against itself. And some of the other elves are like, hey, no good. We don't want anything to do with demons. We know they're straight up 100% bad. Let's just... You guys do that. We're going to go do our own thing. And so the Alija elves came to be. They are focused on exploring and cleansing the city of Nagisa. They're all about destroying demons. And they're happy to have any help in the fight. They'll take on anyone to help them out with stuff. Because they have great records of everything. They use that to help them in their fight. They have entire archives with lots of information on all the demons that they fought and all the information they learned about demons. But with that knowledge, they also understand a lot of that knowledge can be used to call demons and stuff. So if you need help fighting demons, you can go talk to Ali J elves and they'll be like, yeah, we'll help you. But let us go into the archives. We'll get all the relevant information, because secretly we don't want you to use our information to call demons, and we'll come back with it, and you can use that to stop demons. And their intent on keeping records and everything is so great that they even started creating these specific masks that they use to keep track of the genealogy of the specific bloodlines and families among the Ali J. The masks allow you to get information about your ancestors, and you can keep track of information about your family line and history through these magical masks that you can call upon your ancestral information at any time. And when you're making a mask, you as the ancestor to be also provide the information of the mask. You say, hey, my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, I think this will be important. You speak it in the mask, and then later, as the grandchild, you ask the mask, what did grandpa say? And the mask will tell you, and you can kind of pass that on for generations and generations, which is pretty cool, I think.
That is pretty cool. And I've got to say, the art for Nagisa is enthralling.
Pretty cool. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, like, for folks who haven't seen it yet, or who maybe don't have the Mwangi Expanse book, this city looks like silver pyramids with really steep slopes. If they were like out of Stargate or something, they're like really sci-fi looking, and they're just surrounded by these swirling like dark sands. It's a really cool looking place. Like, I'd hate to live there, but I'd love to, you know, go visit or like go on vacation here. Like, this place is neat.
So, let's rewind, you know. This ancient prophecy happens, and there's some other elves that decide, oh, we believe this ancient prophecy refers to all the threats that are coming to the Mwangi Expanse, and we gotta defend Mwangi Expanse from everything that's coming in from the outside, and anything that might already be living here within, not just stuff in Nagisa, but stuff all throughout the Mwangi Expanse. And wouldn't you know it, those elves became the Akuje elves. The Akuje elves are kind of the elves that are most spread out through all of the Mwangi Expanse. They have clans and groups all throughout that are constantly scouting around, looking out for evils, and will keep an eye out on anyone that shows up. And also, if you... This is a minor spoiler for the Age of Ashes adventure path, so I guess cover your ears for about 10 seconds if you don't want to hear this. But the Akuje elves once fought a manifestation of the great evil dragon god Tahak right around Earthfall. And, you know, that's a huge thing. And they ended up saving the Mwangi Expanse and all of Galarian, in a sense, because of, they, of them fighting off this great, powerful avatar of an evil dragon god. So that's some of the evils that they've faced. And then they also deal with things like, you know, outsiders showing up to try to take resources. They deal with evil wandering monsters and stuff. They're kind of all over the jungle. They're the protectors of the jungle. And they're the kind of people that, if you are playing as an adventurer, you know, you might get in too deep, in over your own head, end up facing a monster that you can't deal with, and maybe suddenly a couple of Akuje spring out of the trees, fire arrows on the monsters to take it down, because they've been watching you. They've been following you. They scout. They watch people who move in and out through the Mwangi Expanse and keep track of kind of the goings on throughout the entirety of the region.
All of the art for them shows them, like, with trees or plants or leaves on them. Are these, like, the wood elves, right? Like, anyone who makes an elf and is like, I'm thinking the wood elf heritage. Is Akuje, like, the default wood elf?
Yeah, effectively, but they happen to be, you know, in a jungle rather than a standard other coniferous forest or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's so cool. Like, because when you're looking through the core rule book and you're looking at through some of these heritage, you're like, Arctic goblin or whatever, you don't really know, like, a ton about an Arctic goblin. You're like, where are they from? I think it's so cool to see that getting fleshed out in these lore books. Like, this is that wood elf right here.
Yeah, and they interact most, I think, with the rest of the people in the Mwangi Expanse. They, in keeping up with everything that's going on, they do communicate with the other groups. A lot of the Akuje half-elves are really kind of bridges between the Akuje clans and all the other people, because they can kind of live between both worlds. So there's a lot going on with the Akuje elves. They can kind of be anywhere. And from what I understand, they throw great parties and eat a lot of spicy peppers, and sometimes invite people to enjoy the peppers with them. And that can be kind of rough if you're not used to these peppers.
Man, I love spicy peppers. I would love to party with the Akuje.
So we have the Alije, who believe the great evil is bound in Nagisa. There. Is that the city? Come on.
Yeah, names. Nagisa?
Yeah, Nagisa. Yes. They believe that the evil is bound in Nagisa. Some of the Akuje elves believe that the evil is throughout, and even outside of the Mwangi Expanse coming in. And then we have the last group of these elves, the Kalija elves, who believe the evil is within, or at least the potential for evil is within. So elves are very long-lived. They can live for hundreds and hundreds of years, and the Kalija felt that this ancient evil kind of referred to the possibility of them forgetting... Not necessarily forgetting, becoming distant and callous and uncaring over the years, over the lifetimes. You know, after hundreds and hundreds of years, you stop caring about the humans that keep dying left and right, because they, you know, they die every 50 to 80 years. It's like, well, there goes another human. we're still here, you kind of get tired and grow old and complacent and forget about all the stuff that you've learned, all the stuff from your youth. And that could let you fall into evil, especially if, you know, you might have ended up doing an evil thing or two over your lifetime, but because you've been doing it for so long, you forget that it was evil in the first place. Collegiate are like, we got to cleanse ourselves. We got to make sure that that never happens to us. It's important that this ancient evil doesn't grow up from within and then lead us to become the evil ones that then end up bringing, you know, terrible things to the Mongi Expanse. So they took it upon themselves to learn what they can about evil, to both know it and then be able to stop themselves from falling into it, which in turn has let them kind of, or has led them to conflicts with some evil groups among the Mongi Expanse. In particular, they're dealing with the Charuka that live in Usaru. They're led by the demon lord Angazan, so they've had lots of clashes with that. But they're all about just kind of constantly finding potentials that could lead to corruption, potentials that could lead to that uncaring feeling that they had to get rid of in their life. So the collegiate elves just ignore wealth. Like, wealth is bad. That can lead to evil. Let's not worry so much about wealth. They kind of get rid of... They don't let feelings of jealousy or vanity get overcome them. They don't really have a very strict ruling system or anything, because, you know, soon enough that could lead to corruption and stuff. They value things like the innocence of youth. When the collegiate elves reach impasses in trying to decide things, they eventually, they can't resolve something, they speak to the youngest member among them, who still understands the issue at hand, to make the ultimate decision, because they value the innocence that has been untainted by experience and all the other stuff that can come with years of life. So there's just all about purity of the self and keeping that evil that could rise up within one at bay.
This sounds like most of their adventures are probably monks. Like, yeah. Like who else is like so utterly just like, I must contain the evil within. Like, this is every anime trope wrapped up in one culture of elves.
Mm-hmm. So those are your Mwalage elves, all three of the different groups of elves. A big variety of elves. They all kind of stem from the same idea, but they kind of branched off in different ways. And I think it leads to a lot of interesting dynamics between the elves and then with the elves and all the other groups throughout the Mongi Expanse.
I'm really excited to talk about the two different dwarf cultures of the Mwanga Expanse, because they're both so different. There's such a departure from like your typical steel and hammers, you know, kinds of dwarves, right? Because you've got these Mbeke dwarves, and they look like they live among dragons, and they look inspired from, like, North Africa and, like, the areas that are, you know, very heavily influenced by Arabia. And then, well, let's just lead with them first. We'll talk about the Taralu a little bit after.
So, in a similar way to the elves, the dwarves do have kind of an important thing in their history that kind of led to the culture that they are now. It's not as tied to each other as it was with the different elf groups, but Mbeke stories claim that, hey, long ago when the dwarves were doing the quest for Skye, they eventually broke through the surface and reached the world, the surface of the world, and they looked up, and there's a big thing that's blue. We don't know what a sky is yet, so we just assume we got to keep going. And the stories say that they reached the top of they found a high mountain, and they, dwarves being ingenious as they are, kept digging up and eventually broke through the sky and reached the plane of air. And so a bunch of air elementals are like, what's going on? Where did these dwarves come from? and the people, or the residents of the plane of air, tried to blow them away, but the dwarves are stout and could take that no problem. And then they got offered great riches, and the dwarves were like, we make great stuff, what do we want your riches for? And eventually a cloud dragon came by and explained, oh, by the way, you kind of dug too far. This, you've gone past the sky. We can send you back to where you need to. Oh, okay. Misunderstanding. Thank you so much. Thank you, Cloud Dragon. You're so kind. And that's why Cloud Dragons are their friends. Whether or not that's true, I think it's a great story.
I love that story.
So, eventually, if we go back to dwarf history, you know, there was a quest for Sky. The dwarves were leaving the Darklands to try to reach the surface, and they did. And the dwarves that would become the Mbeke dwarves did get to the surface, and when they arrived, they found the area that they landed in was already inhabited by cloud dragons. History is unclear, but eventually it turns out the cloud dragons and the dwarves get along and they become friends. So they have settlements that include cloud dragons living among them. They are citizens just like anyone else, and they value the knowledge of cloud dragons to help them out with decision making. They're part of their society as well. But cloud dragons are not some infallible being that, you know, we love cloud dragons, they can do no wrong. It's just, no, they're just our neighbors, they hang out here. And sometimes cloud dragons are fickle people, just like anyone else, except when they get fickle, they tend to be fickle for, you know, spans of like a century at a time, rather than just like, oh, today I feel like being lazy. Sometimes a cloud dragon might be feeling lazy for 50 years and stuff like that. So they're just members of society. And the Mbeke dwarves live in a region known as the Turwa Uplands, which is full of bugs and lots of dangerous little critters. And you know what's a great haven? What's a great home nest for bugs? Beards. You don't want bugs growing in your beards, so the Mbeke dwarves shave cleanly and continue to do so to avoid bugs growing in their beards and other problems that come with living in mountains and jungles of the Mongi Expanse. And overall, they're like a merchant. They're crafters. They're laborer kind of people. They hang out in cities, and anyone that lives among them, if they're not doing wrong, they're friends. Anyone who lives with us is Mbeke. Even if you're not a dwarf, you might be a kobold, you might be a cloud dragon. And the Mbeke have been doing this for thousands of years now, and things have been going well. I mean, there are some problems here and there. Occasionally, they're dealing with pirates from the Shackles. There's actually, in the span of, I think, last 100, 200 years or so, they've kind of had these large spats with the Pirates of the Shackles about three times now. We're in the third Corsair War, as it's being called. But for the most part, they're just like hanging out, living in their cities, doing whatever, and being friends, being merchants and being traders and being friendly with each other.
Their culture's so rich and their life sounds so interesting and fulfilling that it's hard to even imagine like one of these dwarves, one of these Mbeke dwarves, wanting to leave and go adventure.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I feel like some of these dwarf cities, the, you know, massive things built into mountains, are probably adventuring sites in and of themselves, right? Like, you wouldn't ever have to leave one of these cities to have a full-on adventure. You might never need to go into ruins or ancient tombs or anything to still be an adventurer.
Or who even knows how many families' holdings have these elaborate ruins underneath that just haven't been used in centuries.
Exactly.
Yeah, these are interesting. Oh man, and of all the characters that could benefit from a dragon riding archetype, this would be the one.
For sure. So going back to dwarf history, there are now the Tarul dwarves, who are the other main group in the Mongi Expanse, and they have an important point in history as well. It's not the quest for Sky. But the Tarul dwarves were kind of in the eastern parts of the Mongi Expanse near the nations of Nex and Geb. Nex and Geb, for those who don't know, are nations that were ruled by powerful, powerful wizards who got into a fight. And anyone caught in between these two nations was dealing with a lot of bad stuff. So that included the Tarulu dwarves. And eventually the Tarulu people gathered and decided, we got to do something about having to deal with these wizards and their magic. What are we going to do? 16 clans of the Tarlu dwarves got together and debated and tried to figure out what to do, and they couldn't come up with any kind of resolution. And after 4 days, they awoke to the sounds of crashing and thunderous bellows and just so much disastrous noise. And all these leaders gathered together. They went to the noise and they found a dying cloud dragon. It's another cloud dragon connected to these dwarves. This cloud dragon by the name of Tannin was injured, was dying, and asked the council that had yet to agree on anything, "Hey, do you mind chilling for a bit and just taking me to where I was born so I can die there?" And with the sight of this dying dragon, the council suddenly realized, "Hey, all this bickering, we should just figure something out. We gotta do good. We gotta help people out." And all 16 leaders swore an oath to help this dragon, and they went back to their clans and said, "We're gonna help this dragon." And eventually everyone decided, yes, we're gonna help this dragon. And the entirety of the Tarlu people took this dragon, and over the course of 4 years finally got this enormous worm, this cloud dragon, to its home, and it was buried. And that's when the Tarlu swore a new oath that war and squabbling between us isn't what we're going to do. We're going to be peaceful people. We're going to be patient, and we're going to learn what we can about others. And that's when the Tarlu that we know today were really, really born. They're there to... The Tarlu people are the kinds that learn as much about other cultures as they can. They try to stop anyone who's trying to abuse magic or break their oaths and stuff. And their big distinctive feature, if you ever look at the artwork, is their beards and their hair and everything are colored in fantastical colors. The Tarlu value specific moments in their life. They're great moments. Let's say maybe when you reach adulthood, maybe when you get married, stuff like that. Key moments in your life. And they also value the mists and the look of the sky and everything that happens at these moments. So what'll happen is you reach one of these pivotal moments in your life, you dye your hair to match the color of the sky at that important moment. So if the sun is setting, you might have a lot of cool pinks and purples and then some oranges there in your hair. If it's twilight, you might have a lot darker, cool purple and dark blue hair. But you as you grow, you will change your hair color a lot. And for the most part, they are kind of the guardians, the keepers of peace among the people of the Mongi Expanse. They are valued for their knowledge. They tend to know a lot, understand a lot about people's feelings and the political goings-ons between different groups. So they're great ambassadors. They're great mediators among the people of the Mongi Expanse.
Is there something supernatural about the dyes that they use? Because when you look at the pictures of the Tarlu beards and hair, it's just so luminous, you know?
I wouldn't put it past them. I mean, it definitely looks like if you were to see these people in real life, that the hair would be kind of glowing and animating and kind of, as if it were the night sky or the setting sun that they saw on that day.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. I just love these dwarfs so much. And if you get the chance, when you pick up the Mwangi Expanse book, if you do nothing else, at least look at the pictures of these dwarves, because it's just so beautiful. The art, they just did such a good job. So the next one we're going to talk about is the Tsongo Halflings. And this one I know a little bit about, right? Like these are the folks who live in the deepest parts of the jungle. They're so reclusive that most people are like, "That Tsongo aren't real. That's just a story, you know?" But then they're about to starve in the desert, and suddenly, like, a plate of berries arrives, and they're like, "Where did this come from?" "Oh, it had to be the Tsongo." Yeah, isn't that about right?
Yeah, you got it. Tsongo, if if you look into the history of the manga expanse and stuff in Pathfinder, there's a suggestion that maybe halflings kind of crash landed in the manga expanse way, 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 way long ago, and they just managed to survive and they became the Sango halflings. Who knows? That may or may not be true. But the point is now Sango, like you said, live among the depths of the manga expanse, and they're kind of reclusive. They keep to themselves, and they are primarily a nomadic people. They don't have too many permanent Sango settlements. I think they have one or two big cities, but for the most part, they travel a lot in caravans. They move around in search for food, in search for resources that they can then bring back to their cities. In particular, they have the city of La Quesa, which is kind of the Sango cultural hub. And they kind of gather at this place three times a year to share knowledge, to share food, to share findings, and share time together. But other than that, they're always traveling throughout the jungle. They don't necessarily have set paths that their caravans follow. When they meet in La Quesa three times a year for the Kane Fete, which is the name of their gathering, they discuss a number of things, including like, hey, which paths are still safe to take through the Mongi jungle, which paths are not safe to take, are we going to make new paths, so on and so forth. So they're constantly changing, constantly moving about, and they're just helpful people. They kind of keep an eye out for things along the way wherever they're going. Because, you know, surviving the Mongi jungle is tough, and they have to rely on each other to survive. And they understand that other people out there sometimes need help as well. There are also people who value storytelling in their culture. They do tell a lot of different tales. Some of them are even laced with, you know, like a lot of fairy tales and fables are laced with lessons. On things that can help out younger Sango halflings. One particular one is the tale of Kalbanar and Mama Anati. Mama Anati is a nickname for Grandmother Spider, who says, "Hey Kalbanar, I'm a prankster. Let's go prank the gods. Come with me, and we're gonna have a good time." And Kalbanar realizes, "No, Grandmother Spider is like the best hider in the world, and I don't think I could keep up with her. I'm just going to stay home." The end. That's the story. The story is sometimes realize when you would be out of your depth and you know, don't get into trouble. Recognize when trouble could happen and just avoid it in the first place. Fun stories like that. The other big thing in the tradition is stick fighting. When they meet up for the Kane Fete, a lot of them indulge in stick fighting. They just, you know, sparring with these large fighting sticks, and it's kind of their big thing, their big, not necessarily sport or anything, but it's an important part of their culture, and there's been great warriors throughout the history of their stick fighting, to the point where there are Sango halflings that are dedicated to still fighting with the fighting sticks, and can use them if you were an adventurer. You know, you could get into the fighting stick and beat people up with that, but they're ultimately, they're that kind of nomadic people that care about each other. The few, not I guess not that, it's not few, but the group of Sango halflings that do stay put, the ones that stay in La Quesa, they're the ones that harvest, that get into farming and stuff like that to feed the rest of the groups. And just, they're kind people. They're nice people if you can ever find them.
Yeah, I think that these are a really interesting take on halflings. And that's kind of what I like about this book the most, is that there's so many interesting takes on, like, these old classics. And speaking of interesting takes on old classics, we come to one of my favorite of all the ancestries. We come to the orcs. And as I understand, these Matanje orcs, like, they fight demons and drink of their blood to become more badass. As I understand it, these orcs are more militant, more martial, more regimented than, say, your bog standard orc, right?
Yeah, they're still known as violent and strong, and like, you don't want to mess with orcs, right? but they don't seem to do that. They seem to kind of focus that towards what I'm sure a lot of people agree are beings who deserve to get torn to shreds by orcs. I think Mataji orcs are probably my favorite group out of the Mwangi Expanse. All the elves and dwarves are cool, and they can have their cool colored beards and fun fighting sticks and everything, but the Mataji orcs are just so cool. They're like so awesome. So the idea, going back to Mataji history, going back to orc history, hey, there was a quest for Sky. The dwarves decide we want to go up through the Darklands and reach what's called Sky. And along the way, they run into orcs and wake up the orcs, and the orcs are very grumpy, and they get into fights. And eventually, the orcs make their way to the surface as well, following in on the heels of the dwarves. And some of these orcs ended up in the Mwangi Expanse. And wouldn't you know it, the Mwangi Expanse is dangerous. And it's not easy to live there if you don't know what you're doing. And a lot of these orcs died, but the few that did survive eventually learned to make it in the Mwangi jungles. And they toughened up to survive the toughness of the Mwangi jungles. And eventually they were kind of going around fighting off demons and other things that were in there when they ran into servants of Angazan, the demon lord, whose name will come up again and again in the Mwangi Expanse. And they fought off his followers and defended themselves against the evils until eventually the one time when they were fighting the minions of Angazan, they found that a lot of the orc brethren who had been kidnapped by these evil followers, these orcs were twisted and transformed into evil beings, and they realized, oh man, these demons are worse than we thought. We have to fight our own kin and free them of this demonic hold and put an end to demons once and for all. Let's just get rid of them. So they kind of, at that point, shift focus on not only just surviving, but intentionally getting rid of as many demons as possible. And over generations and generations of dealing with this stuff, Mataji orcs have even built up resistances to demonic influence. They're very good at killing demons. They are even able to use a demon's blood to send them into a frenzy that empowers them in combat. They are amazing warriors, and everyone in the Mwangi Expanse recognizes that, to the point where if you're walking around, you're hanging out with some Mataji orcs, you are the most comfortable you will ever be in the Mwangi Expanse, because you feel the safest you will ever be, because you're like, I got some Mataji orcs with me. Nothing can go wrong. And if anything does go wrong, these Mataji orcs will, you know, make things better. They'll fight off whatever evil is out there. They'll keep me safe. It's great. And in particular, Mataji orcs look cool. They have this cool set of tattoos that look really awesome. They wear cool armor. But I particularly like Mataji orc culture because they're no nonsense. They're just very direct, very blunt. They believe that anyone who lies or who is unwilling to express their feelings and their thoughts is weak. Because why wouldn't you be able to do that? That's the most important thing. Why would you lie? You know, lying is for suckers. I think that's great. I appreciate that a lot. And they don't always follow tradition. I don't know how to say this. They don't necessarily live in a culture that necessarily matches what you would understand as traditionalists for like orcs and stuff. They're into marrying for political reasons. You know, they do it for power or for sharing resources and stuff. If someone does fall in love in Mataji culture, their devotion is just like put up to 11. Hey, you're that cute orc girl I like, and I'm a cool Mataji orc. I'm going to figure out what you like. Oh, you like, I don't know, you like bananas? Cool. I'm going to find 5 crates of bananas and drop them off your door because you like bananas, right? Here, look, I show you that I know what you like. here's a bunch of bananas, and doing stuff like that all the time. And they're just like very loud and know what they want, and they tell everyone what they want. And a lot of that ends up happening with, you know, telling other people, here's what we want. Okay, we're going to do that. All right. Or here's what I want. Well, I don't want you to do that. Cool. We'll figure it out. And it's pretty cool. And I just, they're great. And tying that to how awesome they are in combat and fighting demons, they're just really cool orcs. And I love the Mutanji orcs.
I like how one of the pictures shows one of these Mutanji warriors painting his tusks with cold iron. And mm-hmm. But he gets it all over his face, and he just screams, "Witness me!" It's so cool.
Would you ever play a Mutanji orc?
So the main races that I prefer is I like the boring human first. I don't know why, it's always kind of have. After mm-hmm. that, it's orcs. Man, I love orcs. I always have, and. The orc that always chooses violence as their first option has never really been my favorite. I think that this orc who kind of embraces society is pretty cool. I like it a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of those boring old humans, hey, there's a bunch of human groups in the Mwangi Expanse as well, so I guess we can talk about them for a little bit.
Now, we covered a lot of these in the last episode. If you haven't listened to part one of our Mwangi Expanse, I can't say series. Go listen to the last one. Go listen to part one to hear about the nations where these people are from.
Yes. So there are a number of different ethnicities of humans among here. They don't get as much detail in the book as the different ancestries, just because humans are still humans in the end. It's just really the kind of cultures and outlooks for their societies that are really different. So we'll go through those real quick. The Bekiar are kind of known as pragmatists. They're very resourceful. And sometimes that leads to them doing things like calling on demons to get power because they realized, oh, that's a useful resource. And sometimes they do end up doing things like being slavers and stuff, because that's why pay someone when I can just take someone to do it for me. So they're kind of a contentious people among the other people among Expanse. They see themselves as just like, hey, I'm just using what's available to me, doing what works to help keep us going. So.
And this group is from Vidrian, which used to be the Sergavan colony that they overthrew and kind of took back for themselves. They're mm-hmm. also from the Shackles and the Sodden Lands, which are some of my favorite in the Mwangi.
Yep. Next up would be the Banawat people, who primarily live along coasts. They are great fishers. They're great sailors. And their lives have kind of been shaped by the different communities that live along coast. They live in villages and stuff. And they're primarily based in clans and stuff, and they differentiate themselves based on what they do when they go out on sea. Some of them go to fish, some of them go to explore, stuff like that. So they're kind of a seafaring people. And, you know, if you need help crossing the sea or sailing around, asking for a Banawat to help you out wouldn't be the worst of ideas.
I think my favorite is probably the Kaldaru, just mm-hmm. because they're so different, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Kaldaru, as we mentioned in the last episode, they're based out of the city of Sengor. They're different in that their appearance is different. They tend to have different features compared to the rest of the Mwangi people. Some of them have slightly paler complexions. They have different eye colors, which seem to be unique among Kaldaru people compared to everyone else. And they are known to be focused on wealth and money. But for most Kaldaru, they see it as, you know, if I can get a lot of money, I can use that to provide for people and help other people out. It isn't necessarily just for the sake of hoarding money. It's to use that money to then help other people out, to, you know, support economies, to buy stuff for my family, to get gifts for my neighbors and stuff like that. The overt displays of affluence aren't necessarily like, look at me showing off. It's me showing, I can help you. I can be a useful person if, you know, if you're looking for a partner. Hey, I'm a good partner because I can provide for you, but I won't necessarily be doing it just to be like, look at my fancy jewels and stuff. It's to do good stuff with that money.
The Mwaxi are pretty, how do you say that? Mousy.
I've been saying Moxie.
The Moxie. I like Moxie. I like that. So for listeners at home, it's Mauxi. I think Mauxi. I think that's pretty good. I like these people because don't they typically like import a lot of, I don't want to say technology, but you know, like they import some of the best of other cultures, some of the cultural developments from other cultures, right?
Yeah, in particular, Mauxi were living in the northern regions of the Mwangi Expanse, which kind of borders Thuvia and Assyria and some of the other Golden Road regions. So their cultures have kind of brought in stuff from these other places, from Thuvia and Assyrian and stuff like that, and kind of mixed into a different style of culture compared to some of the other groups among the Mwangi Expanse. The Mauxi are in a weird spot right now culturally, where older Mauxi are like, we're completely different to Mwangi because of all these Thuvian and Assyrian connections, and the younger ones are like, no, we recognize that we brought it in, but we're still Mwangi people, and it's a bit different. They are kind of a interesting people because politically they follow some of these ideas and concepts that were kind of imported and brought in from these outside cultures. So they're kind of a unique take on stuff. They're, from what I can tell, very North African inspired, you know, with touches of Egypt and stuff like that, that are kind of a cool mix that's a little different than what you would expect from when you say, oh, this is a fantastical African inspired group of people. Yeah, it's a little different. It's a great take, I think.
Now, when the native people took back Sargava and renamed it Vidrine, they didn't just kill all of the colonists from Chelyax. You know, those people are still living, and they call themselves the Sargavans.
Yeah, they're still here. A lot of Sargavans have direct ties all the way back to the ancestors that arrived from Chelyax, but some of them are also maybe intermingled a little bit with the Mwangi people, but they are the white people of the Mwangi Expanse.
They don't like spicy food.
They
want to speak to your manager.
So they are their own unique group. They are kind of, as we mentioned before in the last episode, they're in a weird spot where a lot of them are not being trusted. Whether or not that's necessarily warranted, considering some Sargavans actually helped during the Vidric Revolution. Things are different for Sargavans. They have this kind of unique culture that spawned from Sargava that, you know, is probably intermingled with Mwangi traditions. So they're this wholly unique group of people that are now at this point trying to find their spot in life, their spot in the Mwangi Expanse. Some of them have moved to Blood Cove to try to find new life. Some of them remained in Vidrian to try to establish a spot for themselves. And ultimately, they're kind of the youngest group among the people of the Mwangi Expanse, which means they have a lot of great potential as well.
Now, I'm a little bit confused on the Vidric, because I know that these people kind of centered their culture around their newly reclaimed, you know, city-state of Vidrian. But, like, the Bekar, or the Bekyar are also very Vidric. So what's the difference between these two cultures?
So the Vidric people, referring to these people that, you know, rose up, they took over, or took back Vidrian for themselves. Their culture is really the big thing. That's the difference, is that they are kind of, again, they're a young group. They've been around for a while because, you know, they were the people formerly of Sargava. But they are specifically focusing on forging new ground, blazing new trails for the people. And they have kind of set about creating new philosophies, new ideas for their culture. The Bekiar people did live in the same region as them, but they have completely different outlooks. The people of Vidri and the Vidrix absolutely despise slaves and slavery. Not slaves, excuse me. They despise slavery and all the stuff that came with this oppression that they were used to. They're trying to get rid of that as much as possible. A lot of these other groups maybe just kind of keep to themselves sometimes. You know, they do their own thing. But particularly Vidric people are out there to try to get rid of as much stuff, of whatever is left over of all this oppression and terrible stuff that happened with Vidrian and other things going on as well in the Mwangi Expanse. So they are focusing their identity on who they are now as these new people.
So the last one that gets a full section in the book is the Zenj people. And as I understand, this is like everyone who wasn't one of the ones we just talked about is yes. Zenj. And you've got like two kinds of Zenj too. You've got like the savanna and the jungle Zenj. And I'm willing to bet, like, from the description in the book, they make them sound kind of vanilla. But I feel like they don't have to be that vanilla, right? Like, of all the cultures of Mwangi we just talked about, we didn't talk about Mazale, the biggest city, you know, the most populous city. I feel like that culture might be Zenj.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of Zenj in Mazale. So Zenj, as you mentioned, they're kind of vanilla. They're the most widespread of the people. They are, if you look at Avestan, kind of the equivalent to Tal'dan people. They're just like the most widespread. There's more of them all over the place. They kind of fill in the rest of the percentage. But like you said, they don't, even though you might think of them as kind of the vanilla, the default for a lot of possible ethnicities, you know, if you roll for a random NPC, they're more likely to be Zenj than anything else. That doesn't necessarily mean they're boring. As you mentioned, they are broken up into two different groups of people. They're semi-nomadic people of the savannah, and the kind of, I guess, what's the opposite of nomadic? Settled, I guess.
Settled, stationary. Settled. Yeah, there's a word for it.
Yeah, the non-nomadic people.
Of the jungle. I think settled's pretty good. The settlers.
That are based out of the jungle. So the people of the savannah who call themselves the Zenje, as opposed to the people in the jungle who call themselves Zenju, they are a matriarchal people. They travel around a lot, and they do a lot of herding of animals, herding cattle and stuff, and moving around. So a lot of cattle drives in the Mwangi Expanse, of course. As anyone would imagine, when I say cattle drive, you of course think Mwangi Expanse. The Zenje people are matriarchal. They have these cool, particularly badass women who serve as the leaders of their groups, because to prove that you have to be to earn your spot as leader, once you are voted in, you have to then hunt and kill and use every part of a predator. You have to go find a lion, you have to go find a cheetah or something, kill it, and create a headdress that serves as your kind of emblem in your state of rule. So, I mean, who are you to question someone that can kill a lion on her own, right? Like, yeah. She's probably earned that spot.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So because they move around, they're traders a lot. They trade with, you know, their livestock. They trade with herbs and stuff they find. Meanwhile, the Zenju are based out of the jungle. They are primarily vegetarians. They know what plants to eat. They also know what plants are useful for medicine. They also even know how to take poison plants and fruits and make food out of them and prepare them, which is, you know, not a knowledge that a lot of people know, because it's hard to work with that kind of stuff. You imagine, you know, the puffer fish that is 90% poison, but if you get the right stuff, apparently it's very tasty. So that kind of idea. But they're kind of as I mentioned, they are not nomadic. They are settled in place. And a lot of people come to them for knowledge about medicine and stuff when magical healing doesn't work. Sometimes they have the right plant that can cure something. And they're also kind of trolls or tricksters or kind of kind of jokesters. I mentioned earlier that they cook poisoned fruits and plants into meals and that are safe to eat. But a lot of the time, if someone is visiting from the outside and doesn't know about these things, they'll be like, oh, time to eat this fruit. Good thing we cooked it correctly to get rid of all the poisons. And after that person was taking the right bite, hey, we cooked it correctly, right? I think we did. Stuff like that. Great jokes. But even though they are kind of separate groups, the Zenji and the Zenju groups are still related, and they share a lot of customs. They don't necessarily intermingle very much, but they still are, they both recognize themselves as Zen people, and yeah, they're great. They're kind of fun people, not very boring if you ask me once you look into them.
How did this happen? We're already at time for this episode. We mm-hmm. have to do a part three.
I guess so.
Oh my goodness. Well, I guess that's all we have for you today. If you like this show or any of our other blogs or shows, please consider supporting us. You know what? Forget that outro for a minute. Folks, I know you weren't expecting a part three. I wasn't expecting a part three. But stay excited about it, because this is where we get into, like, the real crunch of it, okay? Part three is going to be the new ancestries. It's going to be a lot of the new gods and which ones are really cool. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the new monsters in it. Part three is going to be excited.
We're going to try to get that all into one episode.
Oh, my God. Well, are we going to do, like, we're going to end up with, like, a full series on the Mwangi Expanse by the time this is done. Welcome to Mwangi Lore with Luis and Lauren. All right. That's all for you. If you like any of the blog show, please consider supporting us on Patreon.com at Patreon.com/NoDirection, because it's the support of our patrons that make this all possible. And if you'd like us to cover a specific topic after, you know, next year when we're finished with the Mwangi Expanse, please join us on Discord to let us know. And while you're at it, make sure you check out the rest of our content on the No Direction Network.
Until next time, I'm Luis.
And I'm exhausted. I mean, I'm Lauren.
Thanks for listening to Legend Lore. And as always, it's been legendary.